about movement as well. We evolved to move our bodies, to chase our prey, to climb trees, and doing that as well is necessary for our survival.
My guest has been Julie Hartz, journalist and author of The Connection Cure, a book exploring the science, the stories, and the spread of what's called social prescribing. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Willamette Week is seeking nominations for their annual Best of Portland Readers Poll. Show your support for KBOO by nominating us for Best Radio Station before noon on Friday, April 25th. Go to kboo.fm and click the Best of Portland banner to submit a nomination. Thank you for supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. Thank you for joining us this Friday evening. It's time for Once Upon a Time with your host, Consuelo.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors
of... Hi, everybody. Here is Consuelo. One more time. Listen to that wonderful song. This is a wonderful world. Even the world this week has lost somebody important for many of us. So it became a little bit cloudy, but it still is a wonderful world, especially at this time of the day, this wonderful evening with my friend Caroline, and she's going to Caroline Martin, and she's going to introduce herself. But before, I want to remind you about our phone number. It's 503-231-8187. And we are hoping to have many call or to ask her good questions. She's open to your curiosity, comment, and suggestion. Okay, my dear.
Oh, thank you, Consuelo.
Welcome aboard.
I can't think of a more wonderful way to spend a spring evening in Portland.
I agree.
In this wonderful world of KBOO and you and your audience. So, wow. You know, before I got in the car to come over this evening, I listened to Louis Armstrong's song four or five times. And I even printed out the lyrics.
Yeah.
Because this is such beautiful poetry in its utmost simplicity. You know, two lines, you know, the bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. So even the dark is sacred, and we need both. And as you suggested, there's heartache this week, and yet there is that bright day and the rainbow and the roses
and friendship.
Yes. People going by, I see friends shaking hands, saying "How do you do?" They're really saying, I love you. Whoa, what beautiful poetry. So
I agree.
Thanks so much. I'm just delighted to be here. This is coming to the end of National Poetry Month. Yeah. So what a way to spend an evening playing with poetry. So thank you for inviting me.
I agree. Okay, give us an introduction of yourself.
Oh, boy. Okay, so life story in 3 minutes or fewer. Okay, Carolyn Martin, born, bred, raised, educated in New Jersey. So every once in a while you will hear a little bit of that accent.
I would love to.
Yeah. Grew up on what they called Strawberry Hill in Woodbridge, New Jersey. There are no strawberries on Strawberry Hill, and there is not Wooden Bridge in Woodbridge. Born, bred, and raised by a multicultural nuclear family living in a multicultural neighborhood, which now is cool. I didn't even realize it back then. We grew up Roman Catholic, so I bought into the wonderful dogma and the rituals, so much so that 3 months after I graduated from high school at the age of 18, I entered the convent, the wonderful Sisters of Mercy of New Jersey. I still have wonderful friends back there that I've known for 62 years.
Yeah.
Marvelous learning opportunities and some challenges. And we'll talk more about the personal crisis that had me leaping over the wall and finally winding up in Oakland, California, where I moved from teaching English, that was my career with the Sisters, high school and college English, to business. And I spent the next 24 years traveling around the country doing all kinds of business seminars. Mm-hmm. I actually got to go to England once, go to Japan once.
Oh.
I probably know every gift shop in every airport in the country, racked up a lot of frequent flyer miles. However, by 2008, burned out, and I retired, and everybody thought I was brilliant because the economy crashed, and there was not a call for management seminars and keynote addresses, so it was perfect timing. And at that moment, I found the rich literary community in Portland. So networking, workshops, finally by 2011 had my first book published. I was 66 at that point.
And wonderful number.
It's a great
Route
number.
Route 66.
Hey, right, baby, right. Yeah, and then just last month had my sixth collection published, Splitting Open the World, which I'll be, first caller. Wow.
Okay. Hi. Who is this first call? Who is calling?
Well, would that be me? Hello, Carolyn, this is Ampy.
Ampy. Hi, this is a student of mine from New Jersey.
Oh,
yes,
I can believe
high school
it.
Student. Hi, Ampy.
And that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. I mean, how did you go from being a wonderful Sister of Mercy and the world's best English teacher to being such a fabulous, fabulous published poet?
Did I pay you to ask that? Yeah, I think I did.
Did you?
Okay.
Just send all the money. I'm fine.
Right. Ampy went to Mount St. Mary's Academy, where I taught for four years. And what you'll find out through a lot of my collections, and this one also, that there are poems that reference the church and dogma and all kinds of experiences. There's a poem about Camden Catholic High School, where I taught. There's a poem about your alma mater, Mount St. Mary's. There's a poem about Georgian Court University. So being an being an English teacher and being surrounded by literature, and being a sister, being surrounded by the wonderful theology that we were taught, it's still in my DNA. As a matter of fact, it was in 1975 that I wrote my first poem based on a Bible chapter in the book of Genesis, chapter 18. I'm sitting at Georgian Court. I'm on retreat. I have the Bible on my lap, and I'm reading the story of Abraham and Sarah.
Yes.
You remember that story?
Of course.
Sure, yeah. Old couple, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, it came to me, two words. I heard two words that I had never noticed before. Three men are coming to announce to Abraham and Sarah that they're going to have a child. And the two words were, Sarah laughed. And I don't know about you, but I don't find too much laughter in the Bible. And those two words started me on my poetic journey, because until then I had never written one poem. I had never written a half a line of a poem. And that was the first poem that started my intention back in 75 of rewriting the Bible from a woman's point of view.
Oh.
So I've got a lot of persona poems, you know, and I still haven't gotten there yet, but I'm working on it. So the theology, the depths of spirituality of being a sister, and you know many of those women, how marvelous they are. They still are, you know. And then teaching and being surrounded by literature just filled me at a later part of my life with poetry. So thank you for asking that question.
Thank you for your call. We have to listen her poem now, so let's enjoy that moment. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Well, say hi to New Jersey from us.
Oh yes, okay? Please. And all of your classmates and all of your friends that have that Mount St. Mary's connection, right?
Nice.
Oh, yeah. You know we all love you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ampy.
We do appreciate.
Appreciate it. Okay. Well, I want to just introduce Splitting Open the World.
Sure.
The title comes from a famous quotation by Muriel Rukeyser.
Yeah.
She said, "What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open." So this collection is a splitting open of my world with my truths about family, friends, neighbors, my truth about being an English teacher, being a sister, being in the business world, my truth about being a Roman Catholic and what that meant as a child. And then there's the truth about ants and a tiger and butterflies. So I go all over the place with splitting open the world. And I'd like to begin this reading with the very first poem in the book. It's on page 13, because it kind of sets up the themes that I've been just mentioning. The book to ask questions of. This actually was an ad for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and many of us grew up with encyclopedias. And this actually happened. A salesman came to our home, and that starts the inspiration for the poem. So this is the book to ask questions of, from an ad for the Encyclopedia Britannica. The salesman spread them on the Formica tabletop, volumes in reddish brown, opaque paper, 1 inch thick. "Here," he said, conjuring dreams of universities, "the sum of human knowledge at your fingertips, every fact you need to know about everything." The fact is, we couldn't afford one book, thick or thin. My mother cooked and cleaned between assembly line shifts. My father blew out his back. Paint barrels did him in. A favorite aunt strung Venetian blinds on a factory floor. another scrub rich people's toilets and sinks. One uncle painted houses by day, spent nights in oblivion. Another drove a truck collecting junk for charity. Too young in the ways of their world, I never asked about the brutal drunks who fathered them, or how they skimped to take us to the Jersey Shore, or why they cussed and clashed over everything except what kept them family. That night, after the table cleared of dreams, I summed up answers I had no questions for. The Catechism's creed, the straightest of narrow rules, the narratives sanctified in Bibles and history books. I'd been schooled. There is no wiggle room between right and wrong, no versions beyond the literal. That's how it was. Sunday church, chores at home, answers spouted up and down rigid rows where nuns kept us in line and taught us well. Decades dissolved before I learned beliefs should not terrorize, and family is more than arguments, before I understood what no salesman would admit. In this wobbly universe, truths strain, turn, twist to revise themselves before ink soaks in.
What can we say? I mean, yeah, I think you are absolutely right that truth is similar in some ways to movement. And life is movement. So what it was true for us when we were a child is not anymore, children.
Right.
And the same when teenager. And as time passed by, our truths are changing because we change too.
Beautiful.
What is not necessary, what do you think? It's not necessary the truth with belief and value. What is a different thing? Because sometimes, especially in the education that we receive, sometimes, often, our education was full of dogma, as you said.
That's right.
So those were not really truth.
Yeah.
And then when we grew up and we became who we are now, we kind of say, dismiss, delete, go out of our life, out of our mind. And the truth was revealed.
You know, I often thought of, you know, we were spiritual children. You know, growing
we
up.
We are all spiritual first people.
Yeah.
Yes.
But now we are spiritual adults.
Yes.
And in several poems, I talk about the willingness to question. See, if we only had answers like the dictionary has, I mean, the encyclopedia has answers. But now, what are the questions we need to see? There is a difference between right and wrong. There's wiggle room. There's all kinds of possibilities that we weren't trained. You know, we were, as you said, we were dogmatized, if you will. And so it's just lovely now just to question. I love the phraseology, I doubt nothing and I doubt everything. So I keep it open. Keep it open for possibility.
I think this is wonderful. And that show your life because you are the way how you diversify yourself, I think is... it showed a tremendous courage, as I told Maura when she was here too.
Sure.
It's a lot of courage and also openness and flexibility. Tremendous amount of talent and quality that allow you to have all these wonderful books.
Oh,
yeah,
thank you. You want me to read another one?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the book is dedicated to my mom.
Yes.
All right. She died 2.5 years ago, age 98 years, 7 months, 11 days. Okay. And she had a pretty hard life, the youngest of five children. Her father was a brutal alcoholic. Luckily, he died at 42. He probably could have died sooner. But anyway, he brutalized his children, And when he died, my grandmother, whom I never knew, she died when I was two, she had to go to work in the Catskills to clean hotel rooms and leave the eldest son in charge of the family. So they had some rough stuff going on.
Very tough.
So I want to read a poem called My Mother's Scars.
Oh, I love that. I have it here in my list.
In your list. Good. Yeah, well, I'm glad we're on the same page.
Because
it's
beautiful.
Page. Thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, and I actually have the photograph that the poem starts with. I can hardly bear to look at that photograph. It just rips me apart.
Okay.
So here we go. My Mother's Scars. The photograph. A two-year-old, vacant eyes, wispy hair, white dress, leaning toward the camera from a kitchen chair, blackened fingers, fragile and forlorn, resting on a homemade doll. The lie, a pot of boiling candy cooling on the front porch step. The truth, a broiling backyard still in a toddler's curiosity. The aftermath, 12 surgeries, one pinky stub, one finger bent, one father's drunken rage, one mother's regret. The woman I knew never let those scars stop her from doing what needed to be done, scrubbing clothes in a basement sink, knitting scarves my brothers wore, storming into rage when I missed dust beneath beds or spots on the floor. Singed and afraid, I'd cringe at her voice and the scowls that wiped the beauty from her face. I'd hide in the neighbor's chicken coop or climb their cherry tree or grab my bike to ride and ride and ride anywhere. 9 decades gone, and still, I can't comprehend how scarves served her well. She fiercely soothed them, while I couldn't bear to look.
It's a beautiful, beautiful poem.
Yeah.
Because it's so, the metaphor about the scars.
The scars, right.
It's like we were talking before. This is so true about all the things that she went through in her life when she was a child and when she was an adult and in her marriage and all the things that she wasn't able to realize, to do.
You know, I think that generation, they didn't have the benefit of therapy. They didn't have the benefit of self-help books or communities of people. Yeah, communities of people that were there to help heal one another. It just didn't have any of that.
Yeah, that I think is so true, because we are who we are because all these women fought for the next generation.
Right.
One time, one young girl asked me, why do you care what I do? Because you are doing for what I work for you to do.
Yeah.
So if you are losing your time and you are not educating yourself and having a good time and traveling and having a lot of good experience, all my work, all my thought for you don't mean anything.
Yes. Yes.
And so this is what we have to be thankful about, our mother, their generation, because we wanted to become completely different in some way or another. They show us what you don't want to be.
That's right.
Come.
Right, right.
Very nice in some way or another. But in a very hard way, because your mother was controller like mine, a lot of discipline, very rigorous. Yeah. But the other day when I was talking with Selima, Queen Selima, I brought the subject. Don't you appreciate that we have that kind of education, but because now that we are alone, we are able to do all those things? And it's not something that it hurt, because we always did our bed, we took care of the dishes, we clean and... I think in some way they prepare us to confront the difficulty that we have to confront in our life.
Right, right. And not have to settle for.
Yes.
That, you know, that we're open to all kinds of possibilities.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, although we didn't have a lot of money, I guess we would say maybe lower middle class.
Yes.
Yeah, my dad lost a blue-collar job that... paid well. He hurt his back, and so my mother had to go to work, and she was not too happy about that. But every once in a while, and I still to this day don't know where she got the money, but she would take me into New York to Broadway, and we saw some of these most magnificent Broadway shows, right? And I'd like to share this poem based on, it was the day that we saw Camelot with Julie Andrews, Richard Burton, and Robert Goulet.
Lucky you,
yeah.
Lucky you.
Yeah, so this is on page 18.
Okay.
All right. Oh, second, oh, okay, we got a caller.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Hello, hello. What is your name?
My name's Kathy, and I'm not from New Jersey.
Kathy.
Hello.
Yes. Do you have a question for Caroline?
Yes. Well, first a comment. So, Caroline, I just finished reading Splitting Open the World, and it's just really a marvelous collection of poetry for so many reasons. I love your levity, and then also the profound insights you have about the human condition. It's really astonishing. And I loved the poem about my mother's scars that I think you just read that. Wow. Mm-hmm. For your mom to live through that and then to carry those scars, you know, through her lifetime and into your family, your her children, you and your, I think you have brothers, right?
Mm-hmm. Two brothers, right? Right.
Yeah, and so, and I was just going to say, I was hoping you'd read Broadway Matinee, because I got to see Julie Andrews much later. I wish my dad saw her in Camelot on Broadway, but I got to see her in Victor Victoria, and I'm just a Julie Andrews fan, so I just loved your poem, Broadway Matinee, so I was going to ask you if you were going to read it.
Very good,
so you are.
The poem is going to be dedicated to you, and let's listen to her.
Okay.
Thank you very much
for
calling.
Kathy. Thanks so much.
And keep enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thanks.
Okay, perfect timing. Yeah, Broadway Matinee, the Majestic Theater, 1960. Before the orchestra takes its first bow, my mother hustles me from the balcony out to West 44th, down 8th Avenue, where masses rush to delis, subways, and happy hour meetups after work. We're running to Port Authority, missing the 5:15 means an hour's delay, and my father needs his evening meal. Settled in our on-time seats, I ask my mother what she feels. My heart aches for one brief shining moment and Lancelot's desperate love for Guinevere. Who knew I'd sing, "If Ever I Would Leave You," to every woman I grew enamored of during seasons of wandering. But my mother's only man came home from war in 45 and stayed. She stares through dirt-hazed glass as miles to Jersey melt away and doesn't say a thing. I wish I could say my father, dressed in polished armor, swords safely sheathed, rode his Plymouth to our main street stop. I wish I could remember him bowing to my mother, his best friend, as he eased her cloak and crown into the front seat, while I, attendant to both, sang, "Tra-la, it's May," from the spacious back. But here's the truth. I can't recall if he was there, or how we got home, or if my mother ever shared anything about duty, love, and fidelity.
Mm.
Yeah, we in Woodbridge, you could just get on a bus and go straight to Port Authority, and then we would run to the show and then have to run back so we can make my father's evening meal. And what you know, as I keep rereading this poem, I keep learning things. The juxtaposition of the romance, although the sad romance, the tragic romance of Camelot, and the lack of romance with my mom and dad. They were not too demonstrative. But anyway, so that was a treat to be able to go, and we saw some of the, you know, the greatest, the golden age of Broadway.
Yeah, and I think also it was a nice gesture. Maybe she has in herself also the love for art.
Yes.
Obviously, she did have.
Yes.
And the curiosity, and was a relief. And she took you because maybe, who knows, if she saw in you something,
could be
your curiosity and
I would like to believe that. That would be like lovely.
Yes.
I would love to believe that.
Because why did she pick you and no other? Or why she didn't go by herself?
Yes, she could have done that. She certainly could have. Right.
Maybe it would have been easier because they didn't have to take care of you. So, no, I think that is maybe a hunch on her part that this... my girl will enjoy this because you behave quite well.
You
didn't have any problems. You were enjoying.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Oh, lovely. Lovely.
I think now I will... We were talking before starting the show, this program, about your humor and your irony. I think it's wonderful, the combination, like... your friend said, your poem are very profound. I told you that when we start our conversation. And I love the poem that you wrote about the woman who gave me, right here, page 48. I took note. The woman who gave Nordstrom my email.
Just yesterday. I got another Nordstrom announcement. We have been trying for 5 years to get Nordstrom's to change from my address to hers.
Yes.
My email address is portlandpoet@gmail.com,
sure.
Right?
You're right.
Hers, she has the audacity to have the portlandpoet@gmail.com.
So close,
right. And I actually tracked her down because at one point I got Nordstrom was going to mail her some items, and I saw the address, and she was in Tennessee at that point. Tracked her down at the hotel and talked to her. So after 5 years of frustration, all I do now is forward. I just keep forwarding all the Nordstrom announcements and the receipts and blah, blah, blah. But it gave me a poem.
Of course.
So, everything can give you a poem.
The beauty is that she doesn't know. Maybe you should send the poem to Nordstrom, and they will want to publish as a good... Who knows?
Okay, go ahead. So here
go.
Right. To the woman who gave Nordstrom my email address by mistake. Call it happen chance or a high-tech fluke, but what fun shadow shopping you and the purchases I'd never make. Take your overpriced Chelsea crew neck top and Levi's high-waisted taper jeans. Fashion statements you'd claim, but what about Goodwill and its lightly used designer clothes priced more rationally? I must admit, it tickled me you returned that ugly yellow hat. $68 was absurd, and straw is nothing to be thrilled about. How about a visor like the glittery one I bought last year? My $3 flea market steal earned slews of compliment and would have saved your face from $65 three-star powder that couldn't screen out anything. By the way, I'm confused by the size of your clothes. Last year, you were a 16. Now you're a woman small. Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig. How many snips and tucks did Nordstrom make for all those alteration bills? By now, I feel I know you well enough to share a memory. Clothes shopping with a mother who critiqued my teenage size and weight to tears. Some days, I'm still in Christensen's department store, hiding in a dressing room, hating to be looked at, hating to be seen. But ignore all that. I have to tell you, I've started to receive reservations for your Hilton hotel stays, and tracking your whereabouts intrigues. Since there's intimacy in knowing what you wear over your oh-so-slender shoulders, arms, hips, and legs, perhaps we could meet poolside in Palm Springs next week. I'll be the one flaunting her ambitious breasts under an off-white tee, her thighs under red Bermuda shorts, sizes extra large, purchased at my local Target store.
It's a very good poem.
Fun, yeah.
And also because it makes the present with the past and your own experience and the irony, and it's very, very good.
Yeah, thank you. What in doing readings, I get to know my poems better.
Yeah.
It astonishes me how that happens. But then to see how tucked into the humor, there is something serious about the body shaming.
Yes.
And I mentioned body shaming several times in the collection.
Yes.
And that's true. You know, and one of the things my mom did do was sew these dresses that were horrible. You know, and I say, I'm born for jeans. I'm not born for these dresses. And the body shaming between among my brothers and my father and my mother. So that hurt.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, but fun, you know, just the humor.
Yeah, I think it's good that you have that kind of, I will say, that is a positive woman in you.
Yes. Yes.
That is your Noe Pollyanna, because you are Noe Pollyanna, mm-hmm. but you have that kind of, not only the kindness, but you have the joie de vivre.
Beautiful, beautiful. Right, you know, the bright, blessed days, the
yes.
dark, sacred nights,
yes.
They come together.
Yes.
Right? I've got to live that way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
Beautiful.
Keep going.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me do a convent poem.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, right. That would be nice.
This is on page 23. I do have a caller.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi. How are you?
You have that kind of, I will say.
What is your name?
That is the positive woman in you.
Yes.
That is your Noe Pollyanna, because you are
this
Noe
is
Pollyanna.
Me. This is me. I just said that. Hello? Hello?
But you have the joie de vivre.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Take it out. Take it out, Hannah. Okay, read your poem.
Okay, yeah. So this combines some convent stuff with some mother stuff. This is on page 23.
Yes.
And it's called Home Visit, Woodbridge, New Jersey, 1980.
Okay.
A weekend away from convent and classroom, lesson plans and evening prayers, and my mother and I share the kitchen sink. She washes, I dry, as chairs scrape linoleum and cigarette smoke disappears. My uncle is trashed, like the whiskey bottle tossed into the garbage can. His wife grouses about Mrs. Garrity stealing her Thursday night bingo seat. My father escapes into the living room for another Yankee win. Miles of time away, and family's the same, I smile to myself, as my mother hands me a serving spoon. I hand her back a rarity. I'm 35 and terrified to make mistakes. She's baffled by a part of me I never share and attacks a greasy roasting pan. Giving it a vicious scrub, she finally says what she always says. You shouldn't feel that way. And what way is that, I want to ask, but what's the point? From critiques about my cleaning skills to the holy rules, perfection is the path to godliness. I've been schooled, 35 and scared to overstep borderlines. Never mind, I say. Did I tell you about the fellow who falls asleep in my class? He must be bored, she says, turning the pan up, down, left, right to check her handiwork. It's spotless now. She seems sure of it and hands perfection to me. It's taken decades and decades to learn about toxic perfectionism. And, you know, that started with the holy rule, and we were to be perfect in our actions, in our thoughts, in our where our eyes looked, et cetera. And, you know, and my mother's way of controlling was to have this cleanly house, one of the ways. So, yeah, to record that, bear witness to that. And I can say now I like the idea of making more and better mistakes faster.
Mm. And what do you mean by that?
But I mean just to allow myself not to have to be right.
Not to be perfect.
Not to be. And what is perfection? I don't even know what that is. What does that mean?
It's a point of view.
There you go. There
yes.
you go.
Yes.
Precisely.
But on the other hand.
On the other hand,
I think that we have been privileged because we are children of rigor. And now the younger people it's hard to see how laissez-faire they are.
Yes.
And that they don't care the same way. Their parents don't want to be parents. They want to be friends.
Yeah.
And so they went from one, we went from one
that's right.
style to the other. And why we couldn't find ourselves in the middle.
In the middle. I guess that's the plight of humanity.
Probably, yeah. We were talking the other day with, I was talking with my friend from Chile too, who live here, who are Catholic both, and about our education and about our rigor. And I think it's coming from our belief or our parents' belief that they pass to us.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, that you have to be almost a saint and live very proud and very hard worker and everything has to be perfect, clean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now we became kind of in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. When I taught business, for years I taught the topic of generational diversity.
Yes.
So we had the older folks not understanding. You know, it was, at that point it was the baby boomers and Gen Xers. Now we're several generations down, and you know, one of the complaints is the work ethic. And I said to the baby boomers, "Where did you learn your work ethic?" And they learned it from their parents. You see, so a manager in an office, you can't expect a young person to walk in with it unless their parents taught them. And so it became the manager's job to define what work ethic in this organization means in order to succeed. And that was a big aha.
I completely agree. I think, like I mentioned the other day to somebody, I don't have any instant gratification. I passed that stage, so I can wait. I have the patience to wait, you see? And this is the thing that I see now in younger people, working around younger people, and for younger even, I said 40 years old.
Uh-huh.
No 15 or 25,
no,
40, right. Even older. And that the work ethic is completely different when you ask them, how do you like the work that we do? It's the work.
Mm-hmm.
That is the answer. And the other day I told one of them, I said, what a pity. Because if this is no meaning to you, you are missing your life.
Mm-hmm.
Look for something that you love.
Yeah. Yeah.
And leave this.
Yes.
So this is the other thing. Everything has to be production, money.
Yeah.
And to consume.
Right.
Anyway,
we could go on for an hour, 2 hours on this.
I think it's more important to talk about what is your favorite poem?
Oh, boy, it's like asking, who's your favorite child?
It's
true. That really is.
But you always have one because it was harder to write or because it came out of pain or because.
Oh, because of because.
We all have one.
All right, I'd like to read one about my sister friend, sister friend in New Jersey.
Yes.
Again, I've known her for 62 years.
Yes.
And she has been suffering for several years of acute anxiety. I did not know that acute anxiety can cause physical pain, and she has been in such pain. And she called me one day, and that phone call then resulted in this poem.
Okay.
And right now I am looking for the poem. Page 70. Okay, so this is to a dear friend dealing with acute anxiety. Your call yesterday was a relief. 2 good days, you said. Back pain eased, heart settled down, and the dough you track through flower beds and trees befriended you. A spirit guide, I laughed, and you agreed. Now you share, you're lost in a forest of grief, family, friends, colleagues gone, and losses devastate. I hesitate to tell you this, for it's mine to own. I've held grief in my arms and walked it up and down city streets. I've stood at gravesides as it crumbled to the ground. I've learned from betrayal and hurt, cruelty and loss, there is no grief like ours, and earth is rich with it. So what to do, dear friend, when your grief consumes? Go outside and find your guide. She's waiting for you. She'll probably advise that grief is a mystery that can't solve itself. Ask her how to befriend emptiness until the joy chasing you catches up. Ask her to confirm it takes eternities to fill voids, and in all that space and time, blessings are yours to give. If you listen deeper than you thought you could, you might hear that grief is another name for love.
I will tell you something that I don't know how you will take it, but I will say, I think that you are still a nun.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
A wonderful nun.
Oh, aren't you? That's very kind. Yeah, again, part of the DNA.
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, yes, and maybe just some sense of compassion and
a lot and, of compassion and empathy.
And empathy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is shown clearly in mm-hmm. your poem.
Thank you.
Very, very clearly.
Thank you.
And I think, yes, it's no. I think those 20 years that you spent in that place, they pay off.
Aww.
So I think was very, very, very good.
Yeah.
Now I would like you to read the page 19.
Page 19.
An Elegy in Two Memoirs.
Oh, I have never read this one out loud.
I like it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I thought it's very musical.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. So we're going to be going back and forth between my father's elegy and then what I will write in mine. Okay. So An Elegy in Two Memoirs, Part 1. What my father wrote in his. Don't hit him. He's only a little boy. My mother shouted through the kitchen door. One misstep, and my father knelt me between the stove and wall, hands overhead, a 2 feet space, a minute too long. The crime? I forgot his cigarettes. Lucky strikes, 13 cents a pack. They kept tab at Schiffman's corner store. Some things you can't forget. What I will write in mine. Only once, a swat on the rear, I deserved. A minor gaffe, he brought the wrong brand of bread his wife, my mother, sent him for. One snide mark took him down. It's your blunder, I sneered when he asked me to take it back. 2. What my father wrote. Off the kitchen, a nook big as a photo booth. My father pulled the curtain tight around his fishy meal, a nod to its sickening smell. No nod to the black man, trying to be neighborly with a few hard-practiced Russian words. My father, the white army cook, knocked him down 2 flights of stairs, translating friendly as mockery. What I will write. My 3 sons, my father laughed, fishing with his 2 boys, softball games with me, until his back broke down along with his blue-collared salary, pushing papers, starched white shirt, indignity for half the pay. Busy was all he ever said when we asked about his day. Busy translated to hating work without complaint. 3. My father wrote. Our story began at Bury Biscuit Company. My mother, your mother, my best friend, boxing up what I baked. A month before I asked her to foxtrot in New York. I shipped out in 42 and she said yes, choosing me over nursing school and smelly cigarettes. I write. I saw them kiss a half dozen times, watched her shrink when he tried to touch her hand. Revenge for a lost career and scorched dreams of white fences and Sunday drives. I begged him to take our side when her anger burned our days. She's my best friend, was all he'd ever say. I can't forget. Yeah, I mean, just... you know, we didn't know until much later that my mother really was book smart. You know, she was practical, but book smart. She was in high school being tutored in Latin because she dreamed of going to nursing school. And then she met my father, married my father, who was 8 years older, and he just fell head over heels in love with her. And he was shipping out to war, and he said, "No nursing school, because I want you to be here when I'm on leave." So there was one big dream of a career that she didn't pursue. And then the second one, yeah, in the poem about he hurt his back and he had to take a lower, even though it was a white collar job, it was a lower paying job, and she had to go to work, which was not the American dream for her. And so she had a second dream of, you know, being the homemaker, being the stay-at-home mom, taken away from her. So, you know, I think back, no wonder she was angry all the time. And no wonder, at least they were not out in the open about their affection to one another. She would literally pull her hand away when he reached for her, and it was sad to watch. But anyway, you know. But as time went on, she found other ways to find her happiness, and she in several of the poems you'll see her traveling around the world. I have no idea how she pulled this off, but she would buy, my father didn't like to travel, so she would fill the freezer with frozen meals for him, and she'd go off and join a group or go by herself, and we've got pictures of her on a camel around
the... So she wake up.
She did.
She did. Wake up.
I know.
Good for her.
But how did she know? She's in Greece, in Italy, she climbed the Great Wall of China. I mean, God almighty. So it's just like, whoa, where was this woman? But that, so then she kind of got, and he allowed that, you know, and I'm sure very gratefully allowed that.
He
didn't have another choice. No,
because
no.
She will do it no matter what.
Right.
Because she grew up.
Yeah.
She grew up and she started loving herself.
That's
maybe
right.
For the first time.
Could very well be claimed her power. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Read this one, Over the Telephone, page 35. The book is... You dedicate to her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. Okay.
I want this.
Oh, this is something. Yeah, and this is a sonnet. So 14 lines, and maybe you hear the rhyme scheme.
Yes.
Okay. "What do you want from me?" she asks each week. At 94, she's ready and can't conceive why heaven doesn't want her yet. I throw her insistent question back. "Do you know what you want from yourself?" My words stop her in her wobbly tracks. The question infers there's something deeper to want than a pair of easy spirit shoes or a tooth repair. And that bladder surgery? Why bother? Her stance, when time's on the run. My mother asks again, "What do you want from me?" I almost dare an apology for childhood taunts you didn't save me from. But her recall is lost. I hold my tongue. Yeah.
We were talking about that one of the most difficult relationship mm-hmm. is between daughters and mm-hmm. mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And she has her own problem with her own family.
Mm-hmm.
And then she carry her scar to to your family, I mean,
mm-hmm.
to you and your brothers and sister.
Yeah.
Well, the only thing we can feel now at this point in our life is compassion.
Compassion. That's right. Absolutely.
This is what I told one of my friends and said, "You don't require to love anymore, but you can be compassionate."
Beautiful.
What is a different kind of love?
Yes.
But
yes.
You don't need to force yourself, but
mm-hmm.
this is the way how you show that you became adult.
Yeah.
You protect your child inside of you,
mm-hmm.
but now you are an adult confronting your mother's sickness.
Yeah.
And you have to behave like an adult.
Yes, yes. And you know, over the last few years of her life, she had to go into a nursing home after living by herself in a single bedroom apartment. And now, this is New Jersey. I'm in Oregon.
Yeah.
We got along so well over the telephone. And this is true. Every Saturday, phone call. you know, and 12 minutes, rarely more than that. But we got famously, you know, and when she died.
Well, she grew up too.
Yeah. But
Maybe you grew up in her view.
Could very well be. Yeah, I mean, to be able to share some personal things with her, which I never ever did before. You know, I'm 35 and I'm afraid to make mistakes. I mean, that's out of her wheelhouse. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Why we don't give the benefit of the doubt in a sense that she showed that wasn't worthwhile to keep paying attention to the thing that from her past and give to both of you a chance.
Yes, a chance
to get to know who you are now, now.
Right.
Even it's the past, but...
No, you're absolutely right.
I think it's a great gift because how many people we know that they don't have a chance.
Right.
At least you can say the story finished with a happy ending.
Mm-hmm.
We were able and capable to speak honestly about who we were at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, yeah, that's a gift.
That is something you didn't have with your father.
Yeah. Well, ironically, I was closer to my dad.
Yeah.
I'm very much like him. You know, just more no confrontation. You know, just
Didn't dedicate any book.
Oh no! An earlier book was dedicated. You didn't know. Now it's her turn. Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were closer to him in what way?
I think temperament.
Personality.
And
personality.
Right, and you know that idea of my three sons. He took them fishing, and before he hears back, he would take me to these men's softball games, and I would stand behind the pitcher, and they would lob balls back. So you know we did a lot of neat things, and he had the corniest sense of humor.
I think that's what you inherited.
Exactly. Yeah, and I can get my friends will tell you I can get very corny at times. So, we would have little family sing-alongs and remember the very first time we bought a reel-to-reel tape recorder, which is awesome. You know, and we just tape these little shows that we did. So there's a lot of creativity.
A lot of creativity going on
back
Artistic.
Then.
Artistic.
So, that's right.
Genetic composition.
There you go. Boy, you're making me appreciate my family more than ever.
Yeah, right. I think we should at this point in our life.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Because when we look around, frankly, we have to feel lucky.
Yeah.
Because they are human. They were human. They were not perfect.
That's right.
They tried to reach perfection, but they didn't.
No. You show me the person who can. Yes. Yeah.
But tell me a little bit now about your present. Are you still in a poetry group?
Do
you have a student? Do you teach?
In fact, on Sunday, I'm going over to Hillsdale Library. There's a group called the Writer's Mill. And once or twice a year, I've been going out there and doing poetry workshops with them. I have two friends. One lives in Bay City, Michigan, and one lives in Lentz. And for almost 2.5 years, we have been meeting once a week and sharing poems. And then there's online communities that I'm part of. So you got to keep the juices flowing, and taking classes. There are such fabulous teachers in the Portland area. John Brem.
The pity is that they're not in Spanish.
That
is a pity. I would love to go to some of this group and to write because it helped to have the community and you help each other and also give you a lot of encouragement.
There's nothing like having a dedicated teacher and getting the students excited and then being supportive and sharing. And I've gotten so many good poems out of classes with these folks.
Yeah, so inspiration.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and somebody asked me, where do you get inspiration? Well, I guess
I can see from the neighbor,
where,
the telephone.
Where, that's right.
From
where?
Nostrum.
From cataract surgery. Ants. And it's everywhere. Yeah.
You are blooming, my dear.
Thank you.
You are blooming. Well, you feel that?
Oh, yeah. In 3 weeks, I'm going to be 80.
80.
Beautiful
80.
I know. And I mean, we have to celebrate. It astonishes me. How could this happen? I think it's the most ridiculous thing in the world because I don't feel 80.
Well, you shouldn't feel 80.
No, I shouldn't.
You don't look 80. Well, you don't behave
80. I was hoping
80.
You'd say that. I was hoping you'd say that.
Of course I would say that because yeah. It's true.
Yes.
I feel the other day somebody asked me about 8 and I said, today I am 155 because I have my pain here in my back and it's terrible. But yesterday I was 55, so I don't know. Every day I don't know if I am younger or older. But age is a very ridiculous thing because everything. Is
number.
How you feel.
That's right. You got it.
And if you feel productive.
That's it. That's
I think it's the most important thing. If you work in a community or you give yourself to a community, to your family, to your friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my thing is we got to be creative or we die. No, and whatever form that creativity takes, like what you're doing right here.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
Awesome.
It's very important to be creative. And in, like you said, in any kind of expression of art.
Right.
Okay, here we are. Well, we are finishing.
Thank
it has
you.
Been very nice
thank
to
you,
spend
Consuelo.
This hour with you and with your fans that made very nice comment, and I agree with all of them. I would like to tell all of you that my next... program is May 9th, and I will have another friend who is a painter. So we will be talking about self-portraits and some of the nicer painters that dedicate their life or part of their work to self-portrait, like Rembrandt, for example. I wish you a good evening, and I hope to have you back May 9th. At 7 o'clock. Thank you very much and enjoy life. Bye bye. Bye bye, Caroline.
Thank you.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman,